program created in Gainesville, Florida, with leadership from our speaker to my left. In the city of Gainesville, they created the first feed-in tariff for solar energy to guarantee a good price for the power that you produce with your panels.
In the U.S.
Right. Sorry, of course. So our speaker is going to put that in context. There have also been some other notable developments. Last year, Florida Power and Light created the largest solar steam generating operation to come online in the U.S. in 2 decades. Yet, overall, Florida has just 4% of U.S. solar capacity, in a state whose solar potential is second only to the desert Southwest and California's. California has twice Florida's population and 13 times more solar generation installed. So to help us understand what's happening here and what it says about solar power in 2011, we have to my immediate left, Pagin Hanrahan, who is an environmental engineer by training, worked in groundwater remediation before going into politics, and 2010 completed her second term as Gainesville's mayor. She's currently consulting for the Trust for Public Land and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund's Renewable Energy Program. I'm doing some other consulting. And I'm hoping that Pagin will tell us about the creation of the Gainesville program and put that in context with similar programs worldwide. Peter DiNapoli, next to Pagin, is Southeast representative for SolarWorld, which is the leading U.S. manufacturer of silicon solar panels. And he has represented the company in Florida for the past 15 years and intimately familiar with the development of policy here. And I've asked Pete to tell us more about the Florida that lies beyond Gainesville's borders and the mechanisms by which solar panels are getting onto rooftops or not getting onto rooftops, or should be getting onto more rooftops. I'm hoping during Q&A he can also tell us a little bit about the anti-competitive practices complaint which U.S. solar manufacturers have just filed against Chinese solar manufacturers. And then finally we have Julie Patel, who is on the screen here, and will be joining us from via Skype from Washington, D.C., where she is a reporter for the Sun Sentinel newspaper and co-author of the paper's House Keys blog. Before joining the Sun Sentinel in 2008, she worked at the San Jose Mercury News, where she won a 2008 National Emmy. And she now covers the utility industry for the Sun Sentinel and is intimately familiar with Florida Power and Light and the history of energy legislation here. And I've asked her to try and tackle one more interesting mechanism for putting solar panels on rooftops called PACE, which I'm not going to try and explain it to you now. I'm going to ask Julie to try and do that. but essentially, it was kind of cut off at the knees by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac a couple of years ago, and now, thanks to the U.S. courts, looks like it may be making a comeback. Finally, Adam Hasner was on the agenda as an invited speaker. He is a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate seat here, candidate for the nomination, and was instrumental as House Majority Leader in Florida in getting legislation for this new financing mechanism passed. I thought he would have been an interesting addition to our panel, but he's on a swing north. Anyway, with that, no further ado, Pagin, take us away.
Very good.
Do try and talk into the mics if you can.
Thank you so much, Peter. Can you hear that?
Is that on? There we go.
Is that better? Okay. First, I want to say this is really exciting to have a panel member on Skype, and it's an innovation in reducing our carbon footprint, but a whole new pressure to keep your office clean. So that's a challenge. And I also feel the need to recognize both SolarWorld, because over the last year and a half or so, I've been speaking on panels and before legislatures and so on. And SolarWorld is consistently the best, strongest, most consistent solar industry advocate for better solar policy. So, Peter, my hat's off to you. I also can't help but note that in the audience is Bruce Ritchie, who is a environmental reporter out of Tallahassee and the first and still the best environmental reporter I ever had the pleasure of working with, although he would say it was not always pleasurable. Used to be with the Gainesville Sun back in the day. I want to actually start with a little bit of a quiz just because this is, I'm sure, a rather knowledgeable audience. I'm going to talk predominantly about Gainesville's feed-in tariff program, which, as Peter correctly pointed out, is really predominantly an international mechanism that we see all over the rest of the world to deploy solar energy. And my question, which I will have a slide on in just a moment, even though Peter did tell me not to bring slides, just polling the audience, I'm going to ask you, what percentage of all renewable, or actually we'll stick with solar, just since this is a solar panel, what percentage of all solar energy across the U.S. in 2009 do you think was deployed using a feed-in tariff? I'm going to ask up to 25%. Worldwide.
Oh, worldwide, okay.
What percentage was deployed using a feed-in tariff mechanism of solar? 0 to 25%, 20 to 50, 50 to 75, or north of 75? Who would say 0 to 25%? Nobody. 25 to 50%? Nobody. 50 to 75%? Okay, we have a few north of 75%. All right, it was 86% of all solar was deployed using a feed-in tariff mechanism, which should tell you that the United States is rather woefully behind. So let's move forward with that then. The first thing I will reiterate is that Gainesville was the first in the United States, obviously not the first in the nation, starting in March of 2009, if you would just page forward.
How do we get full screen? That's what I want to do, put you right up full. Is that it? Okay. I'll work on that.
And since then, there have been hundreds of new solar installations in Gainesville. We are now pressing 9 megawatts of installed solar. I don't have an actual specific number because we're coming up on this year's deadline, October 31st, and I spoke to sort of the godfather of our feed-in tariff, Ed Regan, with Gainesville Regional Utility this week, and he said it was pressing up against 9 megawatts, which would be, from where we started, a 2,500% increase in the installed capacity. And it's also worth noting that there are a number of other municipal utilities, including San Antonio, most recently Palo Alto, Fort Collins, Colorado, and a few states that have also adopted feed-in tariffs, most notably probably is Vermont. So just a little bit about Gainesville. For those of you who don't know, it is located in the heart of Florida, sort of geographic center, south of Jacksonville, north of Orlando. Go forward. We are about 130,000 population, 60 square miles. We're about half of our county's population, but that's 930 square miles. We're most known for being the home of the University of Florida, which if you are a football fan, you know as the Florida Gators. We're about the fifth largest university in the United States with 50,000 students predominantly on, you know, coming on campus. They're not virtual students. And also the home of Santa Fe College, which is about 17,000 students. To a great degree, because of that public side, we don't have a particularly robust tax base. And so we are very dependent on our public utility, Gainesville Regional Utilities, for our city budget. And we transfer about $35 million a year from the utility into the city's general fund, which about covers the police department. So it's a really significant part of what we do as a city government. There are different structures for public utilities across the nation. There are about 2,000. Gainesville is well regarded. In fact, we're one of about 20 with a AA bond rating. And we are governed by the mayor and the city commission. And so I had the pleasure of serving on the utilities board for a total of 12 years. So, next slide. This is the slide I was quizzing you on. Across the world, I want to just note for a moment that I'm going to sort of go back and forth between two terminologies. Feed-in tariff is the term that was really, I guess, literally translated from the German, and it has not been well adopted in the United States. So the Rockefeller Brothers Fund actually sponsored an effort to do some research and figure out what would be a better way to talk about this program in the U.S., and the term that was adopted was clean local energy accessible now. So I kind of go back and forth in these slides. The California Clean Coalition created a number of these slides, and they are very good about always using the clean terminology. I tend to go back and forth because in Gainesville we do use the term feed-in tariff. But again, overall, across the world, clean programs are responsible for 45% of all wind and 75% of all solar PV installed before 08. And then in 09, it was 86%. And again, you can see by looking at the little pie graph that both Germany and the rest of Europe carry the bulk of that, and the U.S. is a measly 6%. Next. So just to give you sort of a brief understanding of how this works, it's essentially a long-term purchase power agreement for 20 years that if you, as a homeowner, a business owner, a synagogue, whatever type of organization, as long as you're in our utility service territory, you are eligible to participate in the program. We actually do it first. We did it just by queue, people who came and got in line, essentially. Now it's mostly by lottery, frankly, because there is a demand for the program. But if you choose to enter our feed-in tariff program, it's a contract that the utility will buy back from you for 20 years the power that you are producing from your solar panels. You, as the solar investor, pay for the capital cost of putting the panels in, and you're responsible for we only purchase the solar energy that you produce, and so if the panels end up dying or something, then you don't get paid, which is different from a rebate. People take their rebate up front whether or not the system continues to produce energy. And then we cover the cost of the program by what we term the fuel adjustment. That's where we put all purchase power agreements. But we have a increase to the average customer's bill. Today, it's just about $1 per month for the average customer. But that's how we cover the cost of purchasing the power back. The price that we pay is set based on a robust look at the installed cost plus a estimated return on investment of on the order of 5%. And we actually, each one of the requirements of participating in Gainesville's feed-in tariff program is you are required to submit your as-built costs so that we can carefully look at that as time goes on. Next slide. So I want to just give a little bit of background as to why we got into this back in, we first started to get focused on energy and climate issues in the late 90s. We joined Cities for Climate Protection and ICLEI, the International Coalition of Local Environmental Initiatives, also known as Local Governments for Sustainability. And then in 05, really the leadership of Greg Nichols, who was then the mayor of Seattle, he sort of evangelized around the country to get ultimately more than 1,000 cities to sign on to the Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, which Gainesville did in 2005. And that is essentially a Kyoto Protocol goal to reduce CO2 to 7% below 1990 levels by the year 2012. We are on track to meet that by 2013, and I'll show you that in a moment. But we did determine by looking at our existing carbon footprint that there was really no way to meet that goal without really working aggressively to change our utilities energy supply. Next slide. So there are really this report is available online, and it really sort of lays out how we were seeking to meet the Kyoto Protocol standard. But essentially, it focused on four areas: energy conservation, energy supply, transportation, and then land use planning. Next slide. And this is just sort of a graphic depiction of what an ambitious goal it is. And it also is reflective of the fact that we have been a place that's grown substantially since 1990. Go ahead. So these are the in the carbon accounting that we've done, these are the areas that we're seeing the greatest reduction in CO2 emissions. The largest is actually another project we have underway, which is a very big and challenging project as well, which is a biomass power plant, which uses wood waste from the forestry and tree trimming industries. But we also have a very strong energy conservation program. In fact, I always say you should first be doing energy conservation before you do anything else, and we do have robust programs in that as well. And then you can see on down. One thing I do typically point out on this slide is that even given our very substantial solar programs, the impact of the solar photovoltaics is not as great as many of the other things that we're doing. Next slide. We did, prior to adopting the program, we did do some public opinion polling, really because there was ultimately a cost impact and we wanted to get a sense of the extent to which there was a cost tolerance among our customers. And so the question was, would you support GRU's efforts to encourage solar energy investment in the community if it would add $1 or less to all customers' utilities bills? And we got a 75% support on that. We actually later polled a question for a sales tax initiative, which did ultimately pass, although we didn't use it for this particular purpose, but we polled the question, would you support using sales tax revenue to put solar and do energy efficiency projects on public buildings? And that was actually 73% countywide. But the thing that our pollster found particularly interesting was that it cut across every single political demographic, from the most conservative Republican to the most liberal Democrat, which was also interesting. Next slide. So one of the things that we did adopt, unlike, for example, many of the European programs, is we do have an annual cap. We will only install up to 4 megawatts per year in order to control the rate impact. We did very quickly queue out through the year 2016, which is how the program had been initially designed, to do a total of 32 megawatts. Although what we're finding is that as the program moves forward, different projects fall out for various legitimate reasons, such as, you know, somebody decides that they're moving and they're not going to do a particular project, or they decide that the cost of doing it isn't to their liking, or so on. And so those are then being reopened, again, using a lottery system. And as I mentioned, the ability to borrow money based on this program is actually pretty good because, again, it's backed by the city's very strong bond rating. Next slide. So this is just a graphical depiction of what we've seen prior to adopting our feed-in tariff program. We had a total of 328 kilowatts of solar installed today. As I said, we're the most recent firm data I had was 7,500 kilowatts, 7.5 megawatts. As I mentioned, I spoke to Ed Regan just this week, and he said we're pressing up against 9 now. So that represents something on the order of a 2,500% increase just since 2009 first quarter. Next slide. And this data is also a little bit old, and you know, it's one of the challenging natures of this particular program is that it's moving so fast that it's hard to keep the slides updated. But one of the things that this really demonstrates is one of the reasons that a program like this makes good sense is that you continue to see greater competition in the marketplace, the economy of scale associated with having more people out there doing these projects. In fact, prior to adopting this program, we had one very good and long-term solar installer. Today, we have about 6, and we have folks investing from all over, not just the country, but the world. We've had some projects that were financed in Germany and elsewhere. Next slide. And I think I'm going to close shortly, but one of the things I just wanted to depict is that the capacity is actually mostly vested in the larger projects and the larger than 100 kW projects, but next slide. The numbers are in the smaller projects. We have a lot of household size systems, less than 10 kW. Typical household might be 5, 6, 7 or so, and the larger projects represent a much smaller number of projects. Next slide. So we do really pride ourselves on the fact that there have been a lot of jobs created out of this. It does contribute to energy independence, fuel diversity, which is certainly something we heard a lot about from the bond rating agencies, a democratization of the grid that anybody can choose to do this as long as they get in the program and follow the rules. And there's a strong amount of civic pride. If you go to the Chamber of Commerce's website, they have information about it, and we've been on all kinds of rankings. The Solar Electric Power Association is this year, I think we were in the top 10, and next year we expect to be number 2 in the amount of deployed solar per capita, behind Palo Alto, by the way, who is now adopting a clean program. So that's kind of exciting. And I think, I just did want to put this in context. The green bars are how much solar was installed in Germany over the last number of years. The red is California, and as you probably know, California dwarfs every other state in the United States. This, again, is from the California Clean Coalition. And so, again, it really demonstrates that this type of policy mechanism really does push out solar deployment or renewable deployment can be done for any renewable much faster. I think I have just one or two more slides. Again, and this demonstrates the solar incidence in Germany as compared to the U.S. Dark red is good and yellow is not quite as good. Blue is weak, and you can see the difference between California and Germany. Next. And the other thing I just want to note, Florida is one of only about 10 or 15 states that do not have a renewable portfolio standard. And yet, despite that, Gainesville will meet all but perhaps Colorado's RPS by 2013. Most of that in the biomass plant, about more than 90% of that is from the biomass plant. But it's, again, we're proud of our reaching renewable standards. And I think we're closing.
Okay,
very good. Thank you.
Super. Pete, you want to tell us about Florida beyond Gainesville? And
sure.
You might want to just make sure your mic's turned on there. Yeah, there's a little switch at the top.
There you go. Hi. I'm Pete DiNapoli. I'm the manager of our commercial and B2B segment business now. So. Since we talked, we had a reorganization internally, and so I have a new title. But I've been in the photovoltaic industry quite a long time, been in Florida, participating in Florida's deployment of photovoltaics. I moved here in 95, I sit on the board of the Florida Solar Energy Industries Association, past president, and then I'm privileged to be on the board, the advisory board of the Florida Solar Energy Center, and pleased to have participated with the Gainesville Regional Utility deployment of the feed-in tariff, and it is really, truly the best mechanism to deploy renewable solar, particularly of all the mechanisms out there. We struggle here in the U.S. With a mix of complex rebates and incentives and renewable energy trading certificates. It becomes a difficult way to demonstrate the true economic proposition for this technology. At the end of the day, it really is an economic proposition that we're giving to our customers, that our utilities are giving to their customers. It's about saving money, and it's also about doing the right thing with the money. It's moving our generation technologies from traditional and conventional hydrocarbons to the new future energy sources of renewables. So it's a long process, but it doesn't have to be, I would say, too long, as it's been demonstrated in other parts of the world. The starting pistol went off, 12, 15 years ago, and the U.S. is just getting in the race, which is somewhat discouraging to a large degree. So, although Florida has really been a leader in solar energy since the late 70s, principally in the solar thermal industry, which it really should not go overlooked. You really have to consider solar thermal as an important part of the overall mix of renewable energy technologies. And quite honestly, here in Florida, it should be mandatory as part of our building codes to adopt solar thermal. As Pejin was talking about, the first and foremost things that we should be doing is energy conservation first. Our buildings today are not very well constructed. They consume too much energy because they leak energy in air conditioning or lighting or other things. So this is the strategy that really needs to take place. But in Florida, we are a regulated environment, and in other parts of the country, the utilities are in unregulated environments. The cost of energy in Florida, there's really like three things that make a good solar photovoltaic proposition. You need to have great solar resource. We are extremely lucky, the Sunshine State. The second thing is you need to have higher energy costs. And we still are operating in relatively low energy costs that are generated from subsidized, highly subsidized conventional energy sources like nuclear, like the hydrocarbons. So the higher energy costs allow for the true cost of energy on the renewable side, solar, wind, hydro, or hydro and biomass, to be reflected as a levelized cost. And then the third thing you need is a population that really wants to embrace new renewable technologies, renewable energy sources, and we're just as a society starting to think about that. And that's the other part of the proposition. So you need those three things. In Florida, we have great solar resource. In Florida, we have a population that really likes solar a lot, as demonstrated in our surveys. But we're struggling because we don't have the cost of energy is low here. And we're not on a levelized playing field, truly, because of the subsidies connected to conventional generation. You go outside of Florida, and where the hot spots are around the country is in those areas that have those three things lined up. They have reasonably good solar insulation, like, for instance, up in New Jersey. But they have higher energy costs, but they also have a population that is very interested in adopting renewable energy. And then, of course, you go out to the west and the same things converge. So that's essentially what we're looking for. And the fact is that they're still dealing in environments that have complex incentive programs. And all of these incentive programs, these subsidies, are natural. There's no industry that does not have subsidies connected to it. A good one is, an example, is the agricultural industry has subsidies typically connected to it. And really all industries are there to, all industries have some form of support for their industries to grow. So with that, the solar industry is nothing. It is not any different than these other energy technologies. So I'm often confronted with, well, the renewable energy industry needs to have subsidies in order for you guys to be competitive. No, we don't. Just take off all the other subsidies with the other conventional generation, and we would be extremely competitive, or what we would want to call grid parity. So in the U.S., the deployment of solar is growing dramatically. I was looking at some numbers. It's in the several 100% over last year. I don't know the exact numbers. And this is a result of those two other things really aligning: the cost of energy and the good solar insulation, and then some of the incentives. The incentives should be like the example at GRU, sustainable. They should be long term. And with an example of a poor incentive program is really up in New Jersey. Although there's been a lot of deployment of solar up there connected to the renewable energy trading environment, because it is a volatile market and it does not have a predictable floor for the value of the trading instrument, this year the market up in New Jersey literally shut down. And it's been because it's been utilized. I mean, it's not completely sustainable. There's like a fix to it, and I'll be happy to talk a little bit more about the activity that's up there as well.
I'm just thinking, can we bring Julian and then
absolutely
in Q&A? Okay, great. Because I want to give Julian an opportunity to tell us about one more.
Sure.
Mechanism that could work called PACE. And Julie, I'm going to try and bring you into the audio now. Why don't you say hello?
Hi, everyone.
Okay, that works good. And I'm going to see if I can give you a bigger picture, too. Why don't you take it away?
So for those of you who haven't heard of PACE, can you hear me okay? Let me know if I'm talking too fast or okay. So if you haven't heard of property assessed clean energy, that's basically to buy, to make energy efficient and renewable energy improvements to their properties, basically helping them getting over the barrier of the upfront costs. And the way that's done is about 26 states, I think it's up to 26 states that now have PACE legislation in place. And what it does is allows counties and cities, local governments, to take out loans, basically bonds, and create special taxing districts for areas of their cities that are interested in participating. And so they create a taxing district just like you would if you wanted to bury your utility lines underground. Or if you've heard of redevelopment districts, it's similar to that. Can you guys hear me okay, Peter?
Yeah. Yep. I think you might speak a little further from the microphone, maybe.
Oh, but is it too loud? Okay.
No, it's good.
Okay. So anyway, as I was saying, it's a taxing district that allows property owners who want to participate to take out loans from the city or county government and essentially use those to make energy efficient upgrades or renewable energy upgrades to their own homes, install solar systems, and then they pay back the loan to the county, to the local government, through a property tax or assessment, similar to redevelopment districts. Now there was most of the legislation for PACE in various states was passed in 2009, 2010, but then in July of 2010, the federal government, the housing authority, essentially said that, you know, flagged some problems with the program. Federal authorities basically felt that, you know, there could be problems if there were people who defaulted on their loans, problems for lenders, that kind of thing. So they put a halt on PACE legislation. They essentially directed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to stop giving approving loans out for homes that are participating in this, or properties that are participating in PACE programs. And so now where it stands is, it's sort of at a standstill. There are different governments that have filed lawsuits. The state of California, Sonoma County, and some others have sued, saying, basically arguing state and local government rights in this domain. You know, similar to what they do for redevelopment areas. I mean, they have very similar property tax structures. And there is also some legislation. I think it's 2599 in the House. I don't remember the Senate bill, but there's a companion bill in the Senate as well. That would essentially allow local governments to, you know, use the PACE program if they comply with certain restrictions. So they would have to, for instance, notify lenders before they do it. They would have to, you know, check to ensure that any property owner that wants to participate has paid off their loans. Not paid off their loans, but has not defaulted on their loans, that they haven't had a delinquency in, you know, in the past 3 years, that they paid off all their taxes, and other restrictions for lenders who are considering approving property owners, approving loans. So that's where it's at. And it's essentially, you know, the argument for it is that here's a way to finance solar power, to finance energy efficiency, and then the property owner can essentially use the savings that they're getting on their electric bills to then pay off, make those loan payments, to pay off the special tax assessments. I mean, in terms of you know, the concerns on the lender's part, it's just that if somebody defaults on their loan, and who's going to pay the special tax assessment? You know, and it could also make home sales harder, because if a potential buyer is looking at a property, not only do they have to worry about the cost of the property, but also paying these special assessments, or perhaps, you know, if somebody's defaulted before them, then making those PACE payments, the special tax payments.
The PACE program is really a good way to get loans, and it is transferable too. So if you sell your house, it is transferred to the new owners.
Okay, thank you very much, Julie. So we've got some time for Q&A. You've got a lot of different models out here for what might work, what might not work. Why don't we just dive in? And I guess the standard.
I think we all agree there's only one thing: feed-in tariff.
The standard protocol is SCJ members and journalists first. And can you introduce yourself?
Okay.
I'm just going to repeat the question so everybody hears and Julie can hear too. So the question is, what were the obstacles associated with development of European feed-in tariffs?
Well, I'm wondering if you can talk about what the obstacles are.
Okay. And what the potential is. Okay. So the obstacles to getting it established here and the potential.
Okay. And I'll speak briefly about Gainesville and then maybe more broadly in terms of the places I've been since then, because I have been invited to speak at 15 or 18 different locations on our feed-in tariff. Gainesville is something of a unique circumstance because we were in the midst of a broader challenging energy discussion. We have historically been a predominantly coal utility, secondarily natural gas. We were getting ready to adopt some new baseload power generation, which, as I indicated, became biomass. And so we had a deep level of community engagement and discussion around energy issues in general. We had something like 40 public meetings on our energy future altogether. It was in that context that Ed Regan, who, as I mentioned, was sort of the godfather of our program, he's the head of strategic planning for GRU, was invited to go to Germany as part of a SEPA trip, Solar Electric Power Association. and a light bulb kind of went off for him, if you excuse the pun. And he came back and said, hey, you know, this thing that citizens have been advocating for, because we did have strong citizen advocacy among solar advocates and clean energy advocates, it really is working in Germany, and let me explain how and why. And we were sort of already primed to do it. So there wasn't, you know, there wasn't a lot of community opposition or anything. There have been a few challenges since then, and I could go into the details of that. Mostly they've been associated with the fact that the program was sort of quickly subscribed. There are a number of large projects that are, you have to be a utility customer to participate in the program, but the customer chooses then who their contractor is, and there were a couple of contractors who were very, very aggressive. They hired attorneys and real estate agents and so on, and they went out and met with all of the largest landowners. And so there's been a little bit of controversy around that. There's been some challenge around sort of those who weren't as successful in the program having debates and discussions about, you know, well, should you have said you have to be a local company? Well, in reality, you can get a local business license online in about a half an hour and $130. And so it's, you know, how do you define that? And, you know, are you telling people who they can and can't choose as contractors? So, you know, most of whatever challenges we've had have come post-adoption because, and it's, you know, most of the challenges are associated with the fact that the program was pretty quickly subscribed, very popular. We didn't hire any new staff to this day. No new staff was hired to run the program. So they're just sort of running to catch up. In the other places that I've been and spoken, a few things, a few dynamics underway. One is that, you know, there is a cost associated with it. And I think Peter addressed that very well. My own perception is that if you do a program well using a feed-in tariff or clean mechanism, the cost will ultimately be, I think, lower than most of the other alternatives because, for example, when you do, say, a reverse auction or something like that, there are relatively high failure rates for those types of programs. And if you go to the website of the California Clean Coalition, Craig Lewis has great comparisons of different policy mechanisms and what's happened. I mentioned one of the problems with rebates is you get your rebate up front or your tax credit, for example, and you don't ever have to produce the first kilowatt hour of power. And so this is a power purchase agreement. So if you don't produce the power, you don't get paid for it. And then the last thing I'll just mention, because it, you know, I actually think it is sort of an interesting twist on this story for whatever it might be worth. There are some large solar interests in the U.S. that have been successful using other models, whether it be a, you know, there are different types of models that, you know, they'll lease you back the equipment. You know, they own the equipment and they lease you the power on a month-to-month basis or... And some of those large and influential solar companies in the U.S. are actually, because they haven't, they've made their money using a different mechanism. They're not supportive of feed-in tariffs, and they actually go out and advocate against them. Most utilities, whether public or private, are somewhat, you know, they are used to making money on the basis of the capital equipment that they own. That's really the mechanism that they historically make money by owning the capital equipment. And so most utilities, when you talk about having capital equipment owned throughout their service territory by private investors, they're not really embracing of that idea. And utilities are a regulated monopoly, and if they don't want it in their service territory, they don't have to put it there unless somebody at the state or federal level tells them to. So that's probably more than you wanted to hear, but I could go on and on this on this topic.
Should we see if there's another question out there in front? Can you introduce yourself?
I know
so
Leon County.
I'll just repeat the question. You know, are there other counties or cities in Florida that are trying to create their own programs?
I know Leon County is doing it, and also, what's the county just north of Martin? St. Lucie County, thank you. Yeah. Geography lesson all of a sudden. St. Lucie County has a program that they've been working on. My own county of Alachua was working on one and then sort of got a little setback because of the Fannie and Freddie thing. I will say, for whatever it might be worth, that if I would defer to
Julie,
because she clearly knows more about it than I do. But my perception is that you can still do a PACE program for non-residential or for residential or non-residential, as long as they don't have those federally backed loans. And what we have seen in our solar programs, our energy efficiency programs, and most other programs we do, the larger portion of your energy demand is coming from commercial customers. And so if you can move forward with a commercial PACE program, setting aside this issue having to do with mortgage issues, I think that that's actually, you still get a huge impact and benefit from that.
Julie, do you want to take that on? My sense was that something like 80% of the mortgages in the U.S. went through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, so it was hard to get around them. But could you still go forward with PACE today? And do you have any sense of what the scale of the potential would be if it was cleared to go by the courts? Or?
The scale of the potential? I don't have a sense of how many people. You're saying how many people would actually participate?
Yeah.
I think there's a huge demand for energy efficiency programs and renewable energy programs. As evidenced by utility programs that offer rebates and other incentives and get filled up very quickly. So I think there is a huge demand, so the potential is certainly there. I think Miami-Dade County also has a PACE program, and I believe that the property owners who participated in the PACE program before last July, basically, when the federal government halted the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae from doing it, they were able to participate. And I do know that some local governments have actually stopped it themselves just to see what's going to happen because of the broad implications. When you do anything with Fannie and Freddie, like you said, Peter, it has a huge impact on the housing market. So.
Another question. Can you identify yourself?
Hi, I'm Bill Comerick, and I'm with Bradford University, and I'm from and I'm wondering, as Peggy said, most of the investor-owned utilities have some projects that they're not very enthusiastic about. So in Boulder, Colorado, there's an argument over municipalization, and I'm wondering if municipalization is something that is being increasingly considered because there's so many roadblocks in other directions.
So the question is a move towards municipalization of power utilities moving forward partially because there are roadblocks to being creative in other ways, essentially?
Yeah, I was actually fortunate to speak in Boulder, I think, a total of three times last year. beautiful place, and obviously a unique political environment. And also, if I understand correctly, their franchise agreement with Xcel Energy was sort of coming due. And it's as those franchise agreements, and they're typically 30-year agreements, because, a utility does have a huge infrastructure investment to put their both generating capacity and also distribution lines and so on throughout the whole community. It's as those franchise agreements come up that then these conversations take place. As far as I'm aware, and there may be others, but in Florida, Winter Park actually pulled out of Progress's territory back a number of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. They took it to a public vote. A lot of money was spent, most of it on Progress's side, as you might guess. And then the citizens voted to have their own municipal utility, which has now been underway for a few years. And one of their biggest issue was reliability. And also they wanted, I mean, if you're familiar with Winter Park, it's a beautiful area near Orlando. Reliability and also undergrounding of utilities. They wanted their utilities underground so that the trees could flourish and so on. They, too, are actually very interested in solar programs, and they're having some conversations around, you know, both net metering and I, you know, I talked to their director, Jerry Warren, who used to be with Gainesville, actually, and they're interested in exploring the feed-in tariff as well. There was a discussion in Sarasota that they ultimately decided to stay with FPNL, but it was a robust and I think good community dialogue about their energy future that had a lot of engagement of citizens, and there were folks on both sides of that, but the commission ultimately decided to stay with FPNL and to re-up their franchise. And then there was most recently a conversation in the Cocoa Beach area. There are several utilities there who I think also are in FPNL territory. But I was asked to speak in those places both about our feed-in tariff, because it is one of the strong benefits of being a municipal utility is that you can sort of decide what fits for your community, but also just about the overall concept of public power, because communities that have historically been served by investor utilities, investor-owned utilities, a lot of times it comes across as sort of a foreign concept that your utility decisions are being made by either elected officials or people who are appointed by elected officials, as happens in Jacksonville, Orlando. And so Tallahassee, Gainesville, Lakeland are all directly the elected officials. But those conversations are taking place, and, you know, I think we'll continue to see some more of that as these programs become more prominent through the media and other means. I would say it varies. I mean, it was a substantial part of the discussion in Sarasota. Again, ultimately, Sarasota decided not to pull out of FPNL territory. Ultimately, I think it's mostly a financial decision, because what ends up happening, if I understand correctly, if a community has a franchise agreement and then the franchise agreement says, you know, before this is, you know, renegotiated, you will have the opportunity to purchase the utility infrastructure. Coming up with that number is unbelievable. And that there are lawsuits back and forth, and there are judges involved, and they say it's worth, you know, X hundreds of millions, and the other side says no. And that's what, and I know where there have been unsuccessful attempts at municipalization, it usually hinges on what the net ratepayer impact is to purchase this utility infrastructure back.
I've got a question for Pete. So we've got this alphabet soup of mechanisms for increasing the amount of renewable energy generally, and solar specifically, the RPS, the PPAs, PACE, FIT. In today's, looking at today's political and economic context, is there any sense in which one or more of them makes more sense, or some are simply a no, you know, no go, and should Buy America play into any of that?
Thank you for that one.
That's a softball for Solar World.
That was really good.
Do use the mic.
Thank you. Well, with regards to the incentivizing for deployment, I think that there are certain things. I'm a purist because the feed-in tariff really is a performance-based incentive, and it pays you as a function of the amount of energy that you're getting off of your renewable energy technology.
But looking beyond which one is the theoretical best, we have no money.
Well,
and we have a certain Congress. What's going to play? What can governments afford, for example? What can individuals afford? What might actually work in today's economy?
What's working today in today's economy is, I hate to get back to it. It's the, if you're talking about hypothetical best, it is the feed-in tariff, and the hypothetical best feed-in tariff, which is not a hypothetical, it's truly the best mechanism, is open, very clear. It allows for participation at all of the segments. This is another key thing as well. I mean, we're talking about not just incentivizing these large centralized plants, these utility scale projects in the tens of megawatts. The beauty of photovoltaic solar energy is that it's a distributed generation, and it's ideally suited to be put directly at the load of the building and offsetting the load of the building. So, sorry. What we're confronted with here is that the U.S. is made up of so many decision makers. We don't have a simple way to have one kind of policy in place. We don't even have a national energy policy to start with. So if we wanted to have one place to start with, let's have a national energy policy that does put carve-outs, I hate to use that word, but it is a, you know, carve-out to various technologies in various segments. You don't want to ignore the residential segment. You don't want to ignore the commercial segment. You don't want to ignore the utility scale segment. So structuring something that really addresses all of them. And guess what? This is, the blueprint is already there. We don't have to invent this. It's been demonstrated. It's already there. It's being utilized in for example, in GRUs. But what we're really always struggling with is that it's perceived as a tax. And it's really not a tax. Utilities go and they get cost recovery normally in their behavior to build generation. And so it's very simple for, the public service. It would be, in my mind, simple for utilities to go and get full cost recovery, put the dollar a month on the bill like they normally would do anyway with the variable of fuel adjustment charges all over the place, but then have it specifically assigned for deployment of these various technologies. So,
okay,
can I just give you one sentence on that?
Yeah, and then I think we have some more questions out there.
Because a lot of times among advocates for renewable, there'd be a debate of should we advocate for a renewable portfolio standard or a PACE program or a feed-in tariff. And what I always say is those programs are not competitive, and they shouldn't be viewed as competitive. They're actually complementary, and I'll just give you a quick example. If Florida had a renewable portfolio standard of 20%, as many states do, and then GRU had a feed-in tariff and also a PACE program, then you can pay for the system using your PACE program so that it's on the property tax bill, and if you sell the house, the person who buys it continues to pay for it. You can have the feed-in tariff paying you monthly for the energy that you're putting on the grid, and the utility is meeting its goal because of the renewable portfolio standard.
Okay. There was a question in the back here. Can you introduce yourself? Oh. Okay. Go for it, Bruce.
Jude, how you doing?
Question from Bruce Ritchie on what the new governor might add to this debate, or actually do.
Well,
Go for it, Julie.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, I was just going to say he's asking about Governor Scott. Yeah. There was legislation proposed the past few years that would, as Bruce knows, that would allow utilities to charge customers to build large-scale solar plants and or renewable energy plants. And the legislation, you know, there were other elements added to the legislation to promote and encourage distributed generation. And the legislation was moving forward it's 2011. Yeah, last year. And this year it was moving forward. And this year, Governor Scott actually came out towards the end of session as the legislation was still moving. There were questions certainly raised about the cost to utility customers and that kind of thing. But Governor Scott came out and opposed the legislation, calling it a tax, a renewable energy tax. And I believe that his position came out actually after a few others, political activists and Tea Party activists had come out against the bill as well. So now I think that there's a chance that Governor Scott since then has also come out in favor, you know, supporting certain renewable energy projects or energy projects that could stimulate jobs. I think it all would depend on the cost to utility customers and whether legislators can find a way to get the most bang out of a customer's renewable energy buck. Because if people are paying for it, the thought is that you should be able to get as much renewable energy as you can out of every dollar that people spend.
Yeah, I'd like to say too that with these programs, the utilities can get their cost recovery. It's really a way for them to keep customers as well. They don't lose any customers. They keep their customers. It's really in my mind mind-boggling that we're not racing to this kind of policy. I'm talking about the feed-in tariff, and the word tariff frightens everybody. That's the main thing. If it was called something else, clean, I guess it may change it.
Want to see, do we have any more questions from journalists out there? Yeah, go for it.
I can talk briefly on it, but sitting right behind you is our policy person, Ben Senteras, who really knows what the finer details of it is. Fundamentally,
this is a question about the trade complaint that's been filed.
Solar World led a coalition of American solar manufacturers to file a complaint against the Chinese government, essentially, for dumping solar products, solar modules, cells, and material into the U.S. to really essentially put the U.S. manufacturers out of business. And it became incredibly evident over the most recent months that this was their motivation. So as the leader in the industry, in the crystalline module manufacturing business, in the Americas, and that's all of the Americas, we took our position and filed a complaint, which we can do normally. It's legal, and the reason that we would have done it and are doing it is because the facts are there, the reality is there. So there's sufficient and overwhelming, compelling evidence of this behavior, which is not new to the PV industry. Other industries have been impacted by similar kinds of market behaviors from the country of China. So we, as the leader of the industry in North America, took it upon ourselves to make the complaint with our coalition partners, who remain anonymous. It's just getting back to a level playing field. That's fundamentally what we're doing.
We're running out of time. You did have a question back there. Can you introduce yourself?
Hi, Jerry. How you doing?
The question is, how do the tariffs come down over time in Gainesville? I think we're just about out of time, so let's focus on those two, please. Okay. So
right, exactly.
Quick question on the digression scale, that how the fit comes down, and also what role the utilities played in killing the effort to have a statewide feed-in tariff.
Okay, and I briefly addressed the fact that if you build a system using Gainesville's feed-in tariff, you have to submit your as-built costs. So as the pricing for the long-term contract is looked at the next year, they look at what the systems have gone in at, what it's actually cost to install them, and then what the return back to the investor should be over that time horizon. So Gainesville's goal is to keep a level 4 to 5% return, which will mean that as the prices of panels go down, as the competition of installation gets tighter and the cost of the installed cost goes down, what you get back for the energy you're selling to the utility will go down as well, and that term is degression. We initially had estimated what that would be, but that degression schedule was actually set aside in instead looking at it annually on the basis of actual installed costs. And I believe from year one to year two, the larger systems went from 26 to 24 cents per kilowatt hour. And I think they're degressing again this year, although I don't know the actual number off the top of my head. The smaller system started out at 30, the household type system started out at 32, and then ground mount systems are less. They started at 26 and then they went to 22 or something.
That's a really interesting distinction, as I understand it, from the European systems, which define the digression schedule for the full period up front, don't they?
I believe some of them do, yes. I do want to make one other quick point, though.
I'd like to bring in Julie on the second question, if you're willing to take a crack at that, the role of the utilities in not helping the legislation to have a feed-in tariff statewide.
Yeah, I wasn't in Florida when that happened, but I do know the general position of utilities is that they have to maintain, they have to pay costs to maintain the entire grid, and so they, if it's a feed-in tariff that is allows customers to generate too much power themselves and sell it back to the utility, that affects sales, obviously, because utility sales decrease. And then they have to spread the costs of maintaining the grid, strengthening the grid over fewer customers, because those customers are already getting credits back. So that's the general position. I know that there are, that's why, in a lot of RPS legislation in other states, where RPS legislation is essentially when a state requires their utilities to produce so much renewable energy. But in a lot of states where the RPS is actually working, they provide the utilities with incentives for producing renewable energy. So they actually pay the utilities to generate energy to incentivize them. Otherwise, they're losing sales. I mean, that's just against their business model, right?
Peggy, you want to add something?
I do, although I'm actually going back to Bruce's question earlier about what Governor Scott might think, I would never claim to have any insight into what our governor is thinking, but I can tell you what I think he should think. I think renewables are going to be a tough sell to this legislature or this governor, because today, because of all of the issues Peter spoke about with respect to the embedded industry advantages of conventional technologies, renewables are more expensive. What I think both this legislature and this governor should be very supportive of is energy conservation and energy efficiency programs. And just using Gainesville's numbers, we put about $5 million a year into energy conservation and efficiency incentives. If you assume that that's 10 to 20% of the overall project cost, which is about normal, you put in attic insulation, they'll give you a little bit back, it's 10 to 20%. $5 million translates into between $20 and $50 million worth of construction work. These are people who are doing insulation, HVAC, roofing, electrical, sometimes carpentry. These are people who today in Florida, they are grossly underemployed because our housing industry has completely dropped out. So it's a job story, and if there's one thing our governor has really embraced, it's the idea that Florida needs to be focusing on creating jobs, and I would say creating jobs in industries that we already have people trained and ready to do. And I would also note that Gainesville's both housing and overall economy have not suffered anywhere near as badly as much of the rest of the state, and I do think that these programs are part of that. So
I would say our experience in Canada would kind of affirm that the conservative government went from being a minority government to a majority government, and therefore in a position to do what they really wanted to do, and they actually extended the energy efficiency grant programs, and I think it was a jobs story fundamentally.
Oh, there's no question.
I just got a note that we are officially out of time. It's 12:07. Lunch is served, as I understand it. It's just a matter of walking up to it. I'm sure.
Let me make one note because I just want to reiterate what Jerry had mentioned, is that this feed-in tariff policy discussion started quite a long time ago. Yeah. And it's still in dialogue, but it should be much more significant.
Please join me in thanking our panelists.
Thanks.
Including our virtual panelist, Julie Patel. Yeah. And I'm sure we can stay for a couple minutes if you want to ask us direct questions, including Julie. We can turn the laptop and you can walk right up to her.